Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of arts and culture. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for host David LaTulipe. And today I'll be talking with Elle Bay and Wiley Naaman Strasser, the stars of the musical Mary Poppins, currently at San Francisco Playhouse. Sherry Young and Clara McDaniel will be here from the African American Shakespeare Company to tell us about their annual holiday production of Cinderella. Lisa Gedeldick will be here in the studio. She created Kung Pao Kosher Comedy, which answers the question, what are Jews supposed to do on Christmas? And I'll talk with two stars from Avenue Q, Nick Rodriguez and Chelsea Caresco, about the new Conservatory Theater Center production through January 13th of Avenue Q. All this during the next hour here on Open Air.
It's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Such a great song. My first guests are Elle Bay and Wiley Naaman Strasser. Thanks so much for coming to KALW today.
Yeah, happy to. Thanks for having us.
It's great to see you.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
So this is the musical of Mary Poppins, the book by P.L. Travers, and the Disney movie from 1964, and they're sort of combined and then reworked in certain ways. So I want to ask you about that and also just such an iconic figure, Mary Poppins, and also you play Bert. And how do you update them for 2018?
Awesome. It's based on the Disney musical a lot in that there's a lot of the same songs, a lot of the general storyline, but pulls in elements from the book that are not there and adds some new songs and some elements like, well, I don't know, spoilers. but there's some characters that are not in the movie that appear, and there's some really significant events that happen in the musical version that are closer to the books that don't appear in the movie at all. So,
yeah. Elle Bay, we should say about you that you have many talents. You're a performer, actor, musician, and this musical must be a great forum for all that you do, and you're also passionate about social justice and community, and it might not be immediately obvious to people how Mary Poppins connects with that mission, but maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, thanks for asking. I mean, the big thing for me in playing this role was that opportunity for that representation, to have a queer person of color in that role and to view her as a queer person of color and what that meant, what that means now as well. I think a big thing that I explored throughout was kind of the coding that she does with the family versus with the kids. And there's a big song that's in the musical version that's not in the movie, Anything Can Happen. And it talks about viewing the world more upside down and viewing the world with different perspective. And to me, it's viewing the world queer, like what beauty, what forwardness can happen when and what change is possible when you're viewing it in that way.
Like the Tea Party on the Ceiling, which I think isn't in the musical.
Not, it's true.
But that is sort of a, you know, that character has such a great perspective on things and does things sort of backwards, and it's interesting that way. Wiley, let's bring you into the conversation. First of all, you two have been friends for a long time, and so I think the casting partly happened through your friendship, did it?
Yeah. Bay was originally offered the role, and as soon as I heard that she was maybe going to be playing Mary, I thought Bert would be a dream to be with her Mary.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, I mean, in terms of taking off from the Mary and Bert in the movie that we all know. Tell me a little bit about that process of finding the characters beyond the sort of, you know, Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah. I mean, like Bay was saying, I think a big part of our attraction to these roles was the representation as queer people of color. And Bert has some things really figured out in life. in terms of the kind of freelance life that he lives, and the acceptance and openness and flexibility and ease he finds through a lot of kind of lower class jobs.
Yeah. And also in terms of, I think, sort of the magical realism of life, and that he can, that his chalk pictures can come to life, and you can step into them, and that I think he and Mary share that sort of sense of imagination and playfulness, but also wisdom.
Yeah.
Have this ambiguous relationship. Like, there's people, it's interesting to me what people decide to prescribe to their relationship from an outside point of view, but that they never seem to need to define it in any particular kind of standard way for themselves.
Yeah.
And so I think that was very, very home to us.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah. They have a definite understanding of what their relationship is beyond the need for definition. Agreed.
And the website is sfplayhouse.org, sfplayhouse.org, and it's running through,
January 12th.
January 12th, yes. Running through January 12th, and there are matinees on the weekends and performances throughout the week. And this is, I mean, it's interesting because the book is by Julian Fellowes, who did Downton Abbey. So it's a sort of interesting group that put it together. But let's talk a little bit about staging and what people can expect. Let's talk about the rest of the cast, your team. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually pretty beautiful. There's actually a lot of people of color in the show, and a lot of people who are at San Francisco Playhouse for the first time, and so they're very excited to be on that stage. And the set is by Nina Ball, which is incredible. I'll say one word about it to not give spoilers, but storybook. Our whole team was really on board with both kind of providing a bed of, like, because people have a very particular relationship with Mary. A lot of people have a lot of deep, deep, deep love for her and relationship with her from when they were young. And so there's a lot of nostalgia that comes in. So I think we had a team that was both willing to play with that nostalgia and also to bring in other elements, such as me and Wiley, in a way to kind of show how it's relevant to today and now. This strong person, this strong femme, be able to guide this very white family, and that's how it is in our show too.
Yeah.
Kind of this, different kind of understanding of the world, or not being so steeped in their own kind of both conditioned and self-perpetuated systems of oppression that they've, found themselves in, is pretty righteous for me to get to do every night.
Yeah. And I'm sure you're thinking of your audience and this mix of adults and kids.
Absolutely.
Who were looking at you and seeing themselves in the future too.
Yeah. I didn't have that representation when I was little, so that's what was important to me, was thinking about, because I'm a teacher as well, and so thinking about all the kids that I've taught and just what I could give them in that kind of way was special.
Early on there was I forget, some a youth that said, oh, but you can't be Mary Poppins. Mary Poppins is white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're like,
actually,
oh, yeah.
My surrogate niece. Yeah.
A young kid?
Yeah, she's six. And she said, wait, Auntie Elle, you're Mary Poppins? I was like, yeah. She said, but you can't be Mary Poppins. How are you Mary Poppins? She's white.
That was
white.
One of the first, like, really affirming kind of experiences that we've had. And people coming up just saying that you... to see someone that looks like me in these roles opens up the story in a way.
Yeah. What did you say to your niece when she said that?
I said something like, well, like, I understand why you think that. Is it because you've seen the movie? And she said, yeah. I said, well, she's actually a character that's from a book and can be all sorts of different, she can be embodied by all sorts of different types of bodies.
Yeah,
I said, and it's interesting what will be different in somebody like my body versus who you saw in the movie. So
right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And how did you two become friends?
We Do you want the long version or the short version? We were actually at an audition. We were going in for an audition at Shotgun, which is one of my home companies. And it was a musician as well. Like, it was like a music...
come in and sing and bring your instrument.
Yeah. So I was actually there early, and I was practicing before going to the audition, and I... was just like basically busking at the BART station at Ashby.
And I knew that she existed, and I knew that she played cello, and I knew that she was auditioning for this show.
And we knew that we had times close to each other because Wiley was doing a show with my other best friend at the time, and so had told us that we were going to be close to each other and to just keep a lookout.
So I saw her busking at Ashby BART.
Yeah. We just kind of ran to each other and gave each other a big hug.
That's the long story.
Yeah, that's the long version.
Well, that's a great story. So you were, when you got asked to play Mary Poppins, you were maybe a little bit ambivalent or just sort of wondering what to do. But I think did Wiley have something to do with your decision? Because I think the casting might have happened around the same time, or how did that work?
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely, that's ambivalent's probably a good word, or more just like curious why I wasn't recoiling from the idea of it. It's not a part that I ever dreamed of playing, I'll say. Mm-hmm. It's not a part. I was not one of those people that had a super, super deep connection to her growing up. And I watched the movie and I liked the movie growing up, but I had a lot of inner patriarchy of conditioning when I was like in high school and like watched the movie again. I was like, I don't remember her being such a and she's not I don't think she is. I think she's super direct. And I think that a lot of society is not used to femmes being that confident and direct. And so I think that she can read for people in that kind of way that is that they can judge her for that. But I don't think that, I don't actually think that she's any kind of word that I called her then. Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, I think it took us a minute to find our in to these two characters.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
As you talk about often dismantling the patriarchy through this, especially in our cast, very white, hetero family. And then also dismantling this family, the entitled, privileged family.
Which is not what was in the book, which is not what and that's why also she had a problem with the movie. P.L. Travers had a problem with the movie because she's like, they're supposed to be working class. They're supposed to be, which is interesting. But I think that is something that the musical took from the movie a little bit, is that they do portray them as a little bit, higher class and more entitled. It's interesting that way. I forgot what the other question was I was answering. Sorry.
Yeah, about, when the casting, when you, when you heard that.
So, I just was surprised that I wasn't recoiling from it immediately. Mm-hmm. And it was because I realized later on, I was like, it's the representation means something to me. So,
But also when Wiley
wanted
was cast
him, was like, would you consider him? Because I needed a partner in crime. I needed someone who I knew would do the work with me and who would be able to have this lens on the play with me and who would continue, because it's a long run too, who would continue to investigate and mine the script and, perfect our dances. And I knew that Wiley would be on board with that. And so that was important to me to have a partner in that.
Wonderful.
As they are. Mm-hmm. As Bert and Mary are.
Yes, it's an incredible relationship. And as you say, it's sort of ambiguous about whether it's romantic or, just friends or exactly what's happening. But they're obviously very close. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So this is SF Playhouse, and it's running through January 12th.
Yes.
Yeah, it is a great long run. So congratulations.
Thank you.
It's gotten great reviews and looks wonderful. SFPlayhouse.org is the website.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun, and snap! The job's a game. And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way. A robin feathering his nest has very little time to rest while gathering his bits of twine and twig. Though quite intent in his pursuit, he has a merry tune to toot. He knows a song will move the job along. Spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
Thank you. Such a great song. You're listening to Open Air here on KALW. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for David LaTulipe, who will be back next week. The African American Shakespeare Company is getting ready for their 17th annual production of Cinderella, running tomorrow through Sunday at Herbst Theater here in San Francisco. Joining me now are Sherry Young, Executive Director of AASC, and Clara McDaniel. You play the evil stepmother in this production of Cinderella. Wonderful. Sherry, I'd like to start with you. You founded the African American Shakespeare Company in 1994, and you also started this annual tradition of performing Cinderella right around Christmas. So tell us why you chose the Cinderella story.
Well, when I started African American Shakespeare, you always think about what are those roles that black actors normally aren't seen in. And as a little girl, I always wanted to see a black Cinderella. I know there was a Brandy version, but she was, you know, before my time. And I never saw that really other than that Brandy version. And my friends and I, we gathered around and we said, well, you know, let's do Antony and Cleopatra and let's do Cinderella. And then everybody said, yes, Cinderella. And it's something for children and for black girls and for black boys to see very positive role models and images of themselves. And it's a very classic story about a young girl who overcomes adversity.
Yeah. So especially great for Christmas, maybe, because I think it's so important to have these values in mind that the stepmother and her daughters, it's all about money and commercialism and coveting more, and that you know, Christmas can be just so commercial, and to be reminded that that's not what it's about and that Cinderella is happy and she doesn't have very much.
Well, it's true she doesn't have very much, but I think what's more, the real story of Cinderella is finding your own voice and power.
Oh.
And making sure that it doesn't matter if you're a scullery maid or a princess, you know, that you're valuable and that you're lovable and that you're worth something. And that's the message that Cinderella talks or speaks to her evil stepmother, played by the lovely Clara McDaniel, who does a fabulous job at this.
Let's talk about the evil. I love that the evil is right out there.
It's out there.
There's nothing.
It's out there. Yes, she's evil and she's evil, mean, but she still has a good heart under all of that.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask you,
so
you sympathize with her in a way?
Inside. Inside. I don't let it show. But, yeah, I can relate to her as being the evil stepmother, but I still want what's best for my daughters.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
So she has a good heart inside?
Inside.
Oh, we don't see it very much on
the
stage.
You won't see it, but it's there. It's there.
I was intrigued to read somewhere in the credits it says, written by African American Shakespeare Company members. So tell me about how this was written.
Well, the very first time, it was myself and a good friend of mine, Everett Alexander. We got together and we kind of wrote the script. I call him my wordsmith. He's the funny man. And then over the years, all the company members create lines or different word settings, and it just developed. And the speech that Cinderella gives to her evil stepmother started off with Delene Patrice Brooks. And everyone adds to it. So every year we're re-looking at the script. It's like, oh, we'll keep that. Oh, we'll take that away. And that's it. It belongs to all of us.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And this is at Herbst Theater, 401 Van Ness Avenue, 4 performances tomorrow through Sunday at Herbst Theater. And the website is
African-American Shakes.org.
That's how people can get tickets.
That's how they should, and hurry to get tickets, because we had actually sold out, but I just released some tickets I was holding on to for our subscribers. I just released it at 11 o'clock today, and please, please, please get them, because do not call me. I can't help you.
Give the website again.
African-American Shakes.org.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about the production, because it's there's a lot. It's there's the set and the costumes and the direction and the production.
Yes.
Tell us
there's
about it.
There's always a twist with Cinderella in our production. When we started many years ago, there was the stepsisters were men. But it was very comical, you know, like all great. The great men playing female roles,
yeah.
Or Jamie Foxx and LaWanda and Living Color, and Flip Wilson doing Geraldine Jones. And so there's a history of that.
Yeah.
And it's just funny.
It's funny.
But this year, there is, instead of a fairy godmother, there's a fairy godfather.
Oh.
Yes. So this year has some new twists. And people think that, oh, I've seen it before. But some years we've had music. Some years we don't. Some years it's different characters, you know, that we add on to it. So it's never the same show year after year.
How do you make those decisions?
I think it really is a collaborative decision amongst the artistic team and the actors and everybody in the room.
And, Clara, you've been in this in Cinderella before. Were you the evil stepmother before?
I was the evil stepmother every time, but when the first year that I came, I did audition for tell the story.
The grandmother
role.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, okay, so Peter, who auditioned me at the time, he said, no, I see something else in you.
Ooh.
And I was like, okay. So we kind of let it go. And then I get a phone call from Sherry saying, Clara, we'd like for you to try you as the evil stepmother. And I was like, I've never played anyone evil before. And then she said, well, just try. But then after I got there and Peter said, I see something else in you. And then after he heard me sing, you know, the power, it's like, evil stepmother, you can do this. And I've been doing it. I wouldn't trade this role for anything else. I love the evil stepmother role. It's a dynamic role. I love it. And I'm glad I'm doing it, because it brought something out of me that I thought I couldn't do. And with the help of Peter, he saw something in me that I didn't see. And I'm grateful for that.
Yeah.
The Step family, they steal the show. Trust me, they steal the show easily.
It's fun.
How has she evolved over the years that you've been playing her? How has she changed?
She really hasn't changed.
Yeah.
She's gotten a little tougher, and that's great, because each different stepsisters are different. So these that I have now, I love them. And they're kind of sweet, but then they're kind of like, and so it just brings out a different side of the stepmother, but she's still that evil, got that evil side of her, which is great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're both teachers and educators, and I wonder about the message for kids. I mean, I'm sure that you've seen the impression that the show makes on kids in the audience, but, you know, Sherry, you were talking about the message of you know, you have power,
right.
whatever role you play in your life.
Right.
But I also see Cinderella as you can be a scullery maid and then be transformed into a princess,
mm-hmm.
and that you can, like we all can be princesses. And so is that also a message or not so much?
Well, that is definitely one of the messages, you know. Right now, I'm in tech, so I know I'm looking like a scullery maid this very second.
You look beautiful.
But come tomorrow evening on opening night,
right.
I want to get all dolled
you're
up like
a princess.
Exactly. Uh-huh. You know, I people should be able to go into any room and be comfortable wherever they are. You should be able to go and hang out in the neighborhood and talk to the homies, and then you should be able to go into the boardroom and handle your business.
Right.
And I think that's what Cinderella also has, you know? So it really is a transformational story. And it's about bullying as well. And it's about, you know, letting people in your lives to do wonderful things like the fairy godfather. Uh-huh. You know, there's people in our lives that come out of nowhere and said, you know what? Here's just a little something for you. I thought you might need it.
Yeah.
And people don't understand what big difference that can make.
Wow, that's a really important message to keep in mind.
And, you know, at school when I'm talking to the kids, you know, they know that I'm doing this show because our school is coming. And they're like, you're going to be the evil stepmother? And I said, yes. And then they like, okay. But then I had one incident where one of my students said, well, I can't come to the show because my mother won't let me. And if I was living with my real mother, I could, but I'm living with my stepmother. So I had to hurry up and say, well, you know what? All stepmothers are not evil. Maybe there's a reason why she doesn't want you to come to the show. But, you know, they looked at me like, okay, you must be really mean because I'm living with my stepmother and she won't let me come to the show. But no, I said, no, they're not all mean. Some of them do what they feel is best for you. So I had to explain that to them by being the stepmother, you know, in the show.
Oh, that's too bad.
I know,
yeah. That's too bad.
But I tried to help them make it look on the bright side of it.
Yeah.
Saying that she's not really being mean. She's just looking out for your best interests. You know, we're not all mean. So.
Yeah. But it is certainly a type.
It is a type.
The
right?
gold digger who takes over and banishes the kids from the previous marriage. And,
Yes.
Oh, this is exciting. So there are only 4 performances.
Yes.
So people should really get tickets.
They really should get tickets. People say, well, can't you extend it? I would like my holiday. So it gives you a little tidbit right just before the Christmas holiday. Kids are out on Friday, you know. They're looking for activities to do. And then when you think about multicultural events for people of color, they're few and far between that's for the holidays, you know, where they're really highlighted in a significant way. So this is one of the major ones in the Bay Area.
And that's why it's so popular, and people should get their tickets right away.
Last year we had someone come as far as Bakersfield.
Wow.
Right. I was like, real for this?
Give us the website one more time for people to get
sure.
tickets.
It's African-AmericanShakes.org.
Okay. And it's at Herbst Theater, which is in Civic Center 401 Van Ness Avenue here in San Francisco. What's coming up for African American Shakespeare?
Well, after we close and we enjoy our holidays with our family, the next show will be in March at the Marines Memorial Theater for Black Eagles. It's a story about the Tuskegee Airmen and how they fought in World War II. And the Marines Memorial is all about the military, so it's a great place to have that particular show, and we're very excited for that one.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And, Claire, I think we're going to listen to a song of you singing. Is that right?
I think it's probably the composer who's singing on this particular track.
Oh, okay.
We'll listen. We'll find out.
Yeah.
Or maybe...
Where you're going, every move that you make. Before you hit the door, I know the road that you're taking. The Ice Queen don't have nothing on me. Don't look at her, stay focused, straighten up and follow me. I'm a bad mama, she's a bad mama. I'm a bad mama, she's a bad. I'm real good at being bad.
Look around you, girl, you're not fit to be queen. No dress to spare, you've got holes everywhere. I might have imitated, had you some class, but it's far too late for grooming. We don't have time, don't ask. I'm a bad mama, she's a bad mama. I'm a bad mama, she's a bad. I'm real good at being bad. Oh, I remember when your father brought you home that day. I took one look at you and said, don't you get in my way. You were just a little girl then, cute and petite, but now you're covered in ash. The only prince that you'll be seeing is the one in your dreams. I'm a bad mama, she's a bad mama. I'm a bad mama, she's a bad. I'm real good at. I'm a bad mama, she's a bad mama. I'm a bad mama, she's a bad. I'm real good at being bad. I'm real good at being bad. I'm real good at being bad.
You're listening to Open Air Weekly Cultural Arts on KALW. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for host David LaTulipe. And special thanks to producer Neil Swinkles and engineer Damian D. Minor for today's show. My next guests are here from the new Conservatory Theater production of Avenue Q, running through January 13th here in San Francisco. Welcome to KALW. Chelsea Carrasco and Nick Rodriguez. Rodriguez, Portuguese.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, great. You play two main characters in Avenue Q, probably the most main characters, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. And let's talk a little bit about it. Avenue Q refers to a part of New York City, and formerly known as the Alphabet City, I think. Mm-hmm. Avenue A, B, and C, and then Princeton. Your character, Nick, is looking for a place and ends up on Avenue Q.
Sort of scene that happens, he comes out on stage and he's in his graduation cap and gown. He has just graduated from college. And the first line he sings is, what do you do with a BA in English? And so it kind of sets the stage for the show. It's all about trying to find your purpose in life and where you fit into the world. And so you just graduate college, you enter that adult world, and you think, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And he's scared but optimistic, as I think most kids who come out of college are. So it's a really good way to start the show about life and finding your true meaning.
Yeah. And then you become a friend and also sort of girlfriend.
Yeah.
You play a couple characters, mm-hmm. Chelsea.
Yeah. So I play Kate Monster and Lucy. And Kate is kind of the girl next door, kind of not really sure what she's looking for, definitely wants a boyfriend and wants to find that love in her life. And she meets Princeton when he comes to the Avenue and kind of gets set up by some of the friends on Avenue Q. And they end up, like, falling in love and going through the struggles together as a couple, and then kind of breaking up and getting back together.
Oh, so my God, it's spoilers.
Sorry. But yeah, it's great.
Yeah. And this is through January 13th at the new Conservatory Theater Center, 25 Van Ness Avenue at Market, mm-hmm. here in San Francisco. And tickets are at nctcsf.org.
Yes.
Yes.
NCTCSF, which is New Conservatory Theater Center acronym.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
So let's talk about also the puppets, and they're sort of like Muppets in a way, or like the Sesame Street puppets, but and played by people who are very present on stage, but it's sort of like Japanese bunraku, where you kind of don't notice the person dressed in black, but you see only the puppet. Is that right?
Yeah, so we're dressed in all black, and yes, we're very much on stage, like moving around so you can clearly see the operators of the puppets. Mm-hmm. But it's a really interesting phenomenon. We're in two different casts, so we get to watch each other perform. And watching the show, it's really interesting. Your eye, after like the first few seconds, just automatically goes to the puppets, and you just watch them the entire show, no matter what the operator is doing. And we were directed to, as the operator, not make too big of faces or gestures to kind of draw from the puppet. And so it's really cool. You see the operator, but you never really watch them the entire show.
Do you start feeling, after you've done this a while, that the puppets are kind of become human?
Yeah, they kind of feel like an extension to you, honestly. It's almost like you're... I mean, essentially, you're not really there, so you're just putting all your energy into your puppet. So it's kind of like your puppet's doing all the work. And it feels now, since we're both doing the show for the second time this year, it feels like second nature now to just use the puppet. And when you're doing a scene during rehearsals and stuff, when we'd be doing scenes without the puppet, it was almost like I was missing something. Like, doing the show, it's very weird to do it without a puppet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're in two different casts, but it must be very intense to do this kind of show now at the end of the year and the beginning of the new year, just because there's so much going on, and just to sort of maintain the rest of your life and be
right.
doing these very intense theater productions.
Well, originally they had it where it was only one cast. I think it was the first two or three years
two
they did
years,
it.
Yeah.
And it was during this time of the year, so flu season, and so many actors were calling out. And we run for 2 months, six shows a week, and so it was just really hard to kind of get through this demanding of a show. And so they did the double cast model, and whenever someone has to call out because they're too sick, you know, we kind of have like a understudy sort of. So that's why we chose to do that model.
So someone from the other cast comes.
Yeah, so say my Kate calls out, then Chelsea would come in, and then we get to do the show.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah. So the blocking has to stay pretty much the same between the two casts, just so if anyone has to jump in, we can do that super easily.
Nick, you have a really unusual biography, and I've never seen this before. It says you graduated from Santa Clara University with degrees in accounting and theater arts, with minors in mathematics and musical theater. And when you're not performing, you work as a financial analyst during the day and bartender in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems like two parts of the brain, kind of antithetical. I mean, the art side and the math side, or the financial analyst side. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I couldn't really decide in college, much like Princeton. I didn't know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And I decided, well, you know, I don't know if I want to go the more practical mathematic finance route, or if, excuse me, if I want to pursue my passion and my love for the arts. So I was like, I'll just do both. So it's difficult to kind of juggle that. But I mean, if you talk to any actor, they always have one to three jobs to kind of support themselves, to kind of pursue their art, because, you know, this isn't something, if we wanted money, we definitely would not have gone into theater. So it's something that a lot of actors, I think, they share that same experience, having to work multiple jobs and to kind of struggle for their art, really.
Is that true about you, Chelsea?
Yeah. So I graduated a year ago now. And I was actually teaching theater for a while, and then I kind of realized that financially it wasn't the best choice. So I ended up switching jobs, and now I'm working in retail. And I have plans to go back to school for my teaching credential. Mm. So I'll be doing that in the daytime, and then doing theater as more of a hobby at night. But yeah, I had the same kind of the show means this to me too, because last year when I first did the show, I was just in that, like, just had graduated college, not really sure what I was going to do. So I think that especially all of us in the show, we all kind of do that thing where we have many day jobs, and then, you know, this is a hobby, and this is nighttime.
But also, so the show itself sort of resonates with your life in a way. It
Definitely.
Sounds like for both of you.
Oh, this is like the most relatable show I've ever done in my entire life, because it's really... I say it's Sesame Street for adults, because, you know, Sesame Street, they teach kids you're all special, and you can do anything and be anything you want to be as long as you work hard and keep a smile on your face. But this show, it kind of fleshes that out a little bit, where, you know what, we're not all going to be amazingly successful, and we're not all going to be happy all the time, but that's okay.
Uh-huh.
And so it's kind of taking the... experience that we expected as a child and kind of reconciling it with what you actually experience as an adult.
Yeah. Isn't there one song where it's like life sucks and then one character sings it and then another one and they all sort
yeah,
of are competing
the opening number,
for like
it sucks
my
to
life
be me.
Is, oh yeah, it sucks to be that. So, so each person thinks that their life is just the worst.
Yeah, so we're just kind of trying to one-up each other, and that's the opening of the show. So that kind of sets the stage for, oh, you know, all of our lives suck for these different reasons, and the rest of the show is us trying to fix those problems, essentially.
Yeah. And who is the audience? Is it usually your age group or
It kind of depends. I guess it depends on the day. What kind of audience we get. So for Sundays, it's generally an older audience just because it's a Sunday afternoon. But I think it kind of varies because we've had not a lot of children because it's...
Please don't bring your kids to the show.
It's very inappropriate. Uh-huh. But I think it kind of ranges. We've seen a lot of like 20s to 30s mm-hmm. come. And I think it's because it's so relatable, as wildly crazy and silly the show is. It in very many ways has so many relatable things in it.
Yeah, yeah. And this is the new Conservatory Theater Center, 25 Van Ness Avenue at Market in San Francisco, running through January 13th. And you also have a special New Year's Eve performance, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A Very Fuzzy New Year with Avenue Q.
Yes.
That sounds like fun.
Come, there will be champagne.
Chelsea, what's it like to play two very contrasting characters in one evening?
Yeah, it's very much a challenge. I have to do a lot of voice changes throughout the show because they are two different people, and they're completely opposite of each other. So I had to kind of learn who I wanted Kate to be and who I wanted Lucy to be and kind of go through that in my own head of what I viewed each of the characters as and then kind of play off of that.
Yeah.
So, so it's very, very challenging but so much fun to just kind of discover these two different people and just be silly with them and have fun.
And there are also instances where, because we both play two characters, where both of our characters will be on stage and we have to throw our voices between the two.
Oh, that's
crazy. So that's been a challenge because at the drop of the hat, you just need to come up with two very contrasting voices. And not just the voice, their personality, their mannerisms, their inflections, like they're all very different. So just at the drop of the hat, having to switch between the two, that's definitely one of the hardest things I found with this show.
Mm. Yeah.
Who is your other character?
So other than Princeton, who's sort of the boy next door character, we have the character of Rod, who's the uptight, closeted, gay Republican investment banker. So probably the foil to Princeton's character, who doesn't really know what he wants to do, but is sure of himself as kind of a person and who he wants to be, whereas Rod, he's a little bit more wishy-washy on his relationship with himself and other men. And, you know, he has this, his annoying roommate, Nikki, who he's trying to get him to be more clean. And so he's very uptight. And so...
that must be fun.
Oh, it's so much fun. I love Rod so much.
Who do you love more, Kate or Lucy?
I think I definitely love Kate because she's very similar to me in many ways. Just very ambitious and hopeful for everything in life. But I also do love Lucy because it's somebody that I've never gotten to play in my life, so it's very out there, and mm-hmm. I love to have a challenge as an actor. So I think I'm kind of biased to both of them. I love both of them, so it just depends on the day.
It's such an unusual production, and the puppets, I mean, the idea of puppets is really unusual.
The puppets are pretty big, and when I saw this at my hometown theater, and the puppets were really tiny. Mm. So I think that the biggest thing that I hear is, wow, your guys' puppets are so big. And I kept getting this note of, Chelsea, you're hiding behind your puppet. Stop hiding behind your puppet. So I think that, yeah, they're pretty big.
I think because you can rent puppets from the people you rent the rights to do the show from with. And those puppets are smaller. I think, don't we own these puppets? I think,
yeah
they made them for this show.
Oh, and they just made them big.
They're real big.
They're really big.
Like, my arm's about to fall off at the end of the show.
I think that people don't realize how heavy they are until they actually hold them. Mm. So Your arms definitely get a workout.
And they're up the entire time you're on stage because you have to keep them alive. That was another difficult thing we had to deal with. If the eyes aren't visible to the audience, or if they're looking down, or if they're super, super profile, then it looks like they're dead. You know, they lost all life, so you have to keep them up and engaged and moving. And
that's challenging.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for
coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Avenue Q runs through January 13th at the New Conservatory Theater Center, 25 Van Ness Avenue at Market here in San Francisco. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Why does everything have to be so hard?
Maybe you'll never find your purpose.
Lots of people don't.
But then I don't even know why I'm alive.
Well, who does, really? Everyone's a little bit unsatisfied.
Everyone goes round a little empty inside.
Take a breath, look around,
swallow your pride.
For now,
for now.
Nothing lasts.
Life goes on,
full of surprises.
You'll be faced with problems of all shapes and sizes.
You're going to have to make a few compromises. For now.
For now.
But only for now.
For now.
Only for now.
Accept the things we cannot avoid for now.
For now.
For now.
You're listening to Open Air, KALW's weekly magazine, on-air magazine of arts and culture. I'm Sarah Cahill, filling in for David LaTulippe. My next guest is Lisa Geduldig. Welcome to KALW.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
Great to see you. You're the founder and originator of the annual Kung Pao Kosher Comedy.
Correct.
Jewish comedy on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant.
Where else?
It's very successful. You're in your 26th year.
I am, and I'm only 36, so I started when I was 10.
Yes, yes, that's obvious. There are performances December 23rd to 25th.
Correct.
So first of all, tell me about how you came up with the idea, which you've been asked many, many times before.
It was an accident. I was doing stand-up here in San Francisco. I started in 1989, and in October of 1993, I went to perform in Massachusetts. Someone who had come through town told me about this guy in Massachusetts who was booking a women's comedy night. So he booked me, and the place was called Peking Garden Club, so I just assumed it was a comedy club. And I got there, and it was a Chinese restaurant, because that was the location in town that he was able to find to put on a comedy show. So I had the most ironic experience of telling Jewish jokes at a Chinese restaurant. I called a friend in New York the next day and told her about this experience. And out of that conversation came the joke of an idea of doing a Jewish comedy night on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant, because it's a tradition that Jews will typically go to a Chinese restaurant and a movie on Christmas, because we don't celebrate Christmas, Chinese restaurants are open.
Right.
And then we kind of tweaked that tradition from movie to comedy. And then I came back to town and couldn't get the idea out of my mind, and asked some comedian friends if they were available, looked around for a Chinese restaurant, and the show took off. We had 400 people, 200 people turned away.
Wow.
The next year I added another show. The following year another two shows, and it just kept growing. And Henny Youngman headlined the show.
That's amazing.
In the fourth year. And it's just taken off. So it's 3 days, two shows a day. And I've had headliners from, like I mentioned, Henny Youngman, David Brenner, Shelley Berman, Carol Leifer is the headliner this year, Judy Gold, Kathy Ladman, just the whole who's who of Jewish comedians who are still alive.
So how do the Chinese restaurants respond when you say this is what we want to do on Christmas?
Well, this is the third restaurant in 26 years. So the first restaurant had no idea what I was talking about. And at first I was just trying to explain the concept of Jews and Chinese food. And then I realized I should just ask, do you have a banquet room? Is it available on Christmas Eve? And then we moved to a different restaurant for the next couple of years. And then I hired Henny Youngman in 1997. And the restaurant we had been using had a banquet room up a flight of stairs, and my friends had been carrying up people in wheelchairs because I didn't know there was a wheelchair accessible location. Oh. And then in 1997, when Henny was going to be headlining at 91 years old and wouldn't be able to climb a set of stairs, I found one restaurant, New Asia restaurant, that is wheelchair accessible. So they understand the concept now. You know, I'm constantly saying, you know, no pork, no MSG. We have to take down the Christmas tree and the Christmas lights. but at first it was like, what are you talking about? But if it was New York, it would be understandable because, you know, it's just a more Jewish city,
yeah,
per se than, yeah, San Francisco.
So Sunday, December 23rd, Monday, December 24th, and Tuesday, December 25th. And I think the 5 o'clock show is sold out, is
correct?
That true?
Each day we have a 5 o'clock dinner show, which has a 6-course meal, and an 8:30 cocktail show, which is a misnomer, but that's what I started calling it years ago and can't change it. And that has vegetarian dim sum. So all the 5 o'clock dinner shows are sold out, but we still have tickets for the 8:30 cocktail shows.
8:30 cocktail shows on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday.
Correct.
Including Christmas Day,
yeah,
and Christmas Eve. And people can get tickets at koshercomedy.com?
Correct.
Koshercomedy.com.
Yeah, and they should, okay, get advance tickets because the whole run might be sold out by Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Last year it was. Some years it's completely sold out. Other times we have some tickets left at the door.
It's the New Asia Restaurant, 772 Pacific Avenue, near Grant and Stockton. So in Chinatown,
mm-hmm,
in San Francisco.
It's in the heart of Chinatown, and it doesn't look like there's anything going on different that day. It doesn't look like it's Christmas. It's Chinatown. It's packed. People are shopping, and it's just business as usual. And there are three garages within the area that we suggest people park at.
Tell us about who people can see and hear this year.
So this year's headliner is Carol Leifer, who had headlined about 20 years ago. She was a head writer for Seinfeld. She's written on Modern Family. She's a consulting producer for Curb Your Enthusiasm. She's been on Letterman 25 times, and she's written for the Oscars, and she's a big name. She's a household name. And then local comedian Joseph Nguyen, last name N-G-U-Y-E-N, which is a Vietnamese name. So his father is a Vietnamese refugee and his mother is Jewish, who, mm-hmm, come from Eastern Europe and then went to the Dominican Republic, then came to the U.S. So he's Jewish and Vietnamese and grew up in Atlanta and basically said on his birth certificate, you're going to be a comedian with that background. And then Jordan Ferber is a comedian out of New York who I discovered by Googling Jewish comedians, and that's how I often find people if I haven't worked with them or they haven't approached me or someone hasn't recommended them. So there's the three of them, and then myself. I act as the MC. I perform and introduce everybody. And every year I give partial proceeds to a couple of different organizations because I believe in the social justice aspect of producing events. And this year, Jewish Family and Children's Services of the East Bay has a project called Refugee and Immigrant Services and Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. So that raised some money and awareness for different organizations as well as provide a background for what people can do on Christmas. And it's not just Jewish audience. Basically, people come who like comedy, who don't have plans. People come in from around the country, around the world, and find out about it on the internet. Some people have come to town for the show and visited family and then made a tradition of it. And, you know, there's this woman who comes in every year from Baltimore. A couple comes up from L.A., I have people from Finland, the UK, and my box office tells me where everyone comes from so I can welcome them at the show. It's sort of like an old Catskills, you know, family environment.
Yeah.
I call it a bar mitzvah, but it's someone else's family. And there are 10 people to a table. So some people will reserve an entire table. Mm-hmm. Other people come with 2, 3, 4 people. And what I want to stress is that if anyone's listening and they don't have plans and don't have someone to go with, that you can come by yourself because there are tables of 10. So you'll be sitting with what I call 9 friendly strangers. So you won't be alone.
So if people come to the 8:30 show, can they still get some dinner?
Only vegetarian dim sum comes with that because the restaurant is not going to be cooking on top of the
So they should have
order.
Dinner beforehand.
Yeah, have a little bite beforehand. Yeah. We also have Yiddish proverbs and the fortune cookies.
Oh.
So there are different sayings like, with one tuchus, you can't dance at 2 weddings, which means you can't be in 2 places at once. Or a goat may have a beard, but that doesn't make it a rabbi.
Mm.
Or if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a bus, you know, which basically means like if this happened, you know, just something that's so far-fetched.
Yeah.
So there's just little kitsch things like that.
What did your family do on Christmas?
We didn't do Christmas. We didn't do anything. If it was a Sunday, we went out for Chinese food. We didn't typically go to a Chinese restaurant on Christmas Eve, but traditionally, in New York at least, Jews would go to a Chinese restaurant on Sunday nights. And I don't know the origin of it. Some people say because the maid had off, but we certainly didn't have a maid. And we weren't kosher. We had shrimp and lobster sauce. One of the dishes on the dinner menu I call kosher prawns, which there's no way that prawns can be kosher, but I just say they were blessed by a very, 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 very reform rabbi. So we didn't do Christmas. I mean, I grew up in a largely Jewish area on Long Island. Almost everyone was Jewish except for the Mazzolas next door who had what seemed like the most gigantic nativity scene on their front lawn. And to me, it was just, I didn't really know much about the culture because I might as well have been in Israel growing up on Long Island.
Oh, yeah. And what was Hanukkah like?
Hanukkah was lighting candles and, you know, we weren't a big present-giving family, but other people would give a present each night. But it was just lighting candles and making potato pancakes, potato latkes.
Latkes.
If my grandmother would come through the door, we would just hand her a grater and have a bag of potatoes and onions in the kitchen. And if anyone's listening and they want my grandma's recipe, you grate half the potatoes, and the other half you boil and mash in, so it makes it nice and spongy.
You have to do a lot of squeezing, though, of the potato, the grated potatoes.
Yeah, to get the eggs out. And then you have to get rid of a lot of oil by either the use of paper towels or Grandma Lily's method of paper bags from the grocery store.
Oh, yeah. Good for Grandma Lily.
From the old country, Grandma Lily.
So Sunday, December 23rd, Monday, December 24th, Tuesday, December 25th, because a lot of people don't know what to do with Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is great. 8:30, the 5 o'clock dinner show is sold out, but the 8:30 cocktail show is available for all 3 nights. Kung Pao Kosher Comedy, 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I had no idea that it was going to fly even the first year. And then I said, okay, let's call the second one the second annual. And then that year I got a New York Times article.
Ah.
And then that took off.
Yeah.
And then people just kept coming back, and I just kept adding it. So if we have a complete sellout, it's over 2,200 people over the course of the 6 shows. So we'll keep doing it until people stop coming, I guess.
Yeah. KosherComedy.com is the website for tickets. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right now you are down and out and feeling really crappy.
I'll see.
And when I see how sad you are, it sort of makes me happy.
Happy.
Sorry, Nikki, human nature, nothing I can do. It's Schadenfreude.
That's not very nice, Gary.
I didn't say it was nice, but everybody does it.
Special thanks to Open Air producer Neil Swinkles and board operator Damian D. Minor for making today's show possible. I'm Sarah Cahill. A reminder that you can hear this or any recent editions of Open Air at our website, kalw.org.